be here a few minutes after the session is over to answer any additional questions. So what we want to do is have our last presentation. It's going to be delivered by Dr. Clifford Mitchell, who is the Environmental Health Coordination and Public Health Residency Program at the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. I hope I got that right. He's going to speak to us about the public policy considerations when utilizing biomonitoring, so filling out just another one of the components that would be part of what's shared through a national biomonitoring system. Dr. Mitchell is the Assistant Director of Environmental Health and Food Protection in the Infectious Disease and Health Administration of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. His responsibilities include food protection and regulation, regulation of medical waste, tanning, indoor smoking, and hazards in consumer products, surveillance of environmental and occupational health events, and public health response to environmental exposures. He has been at DHMH since 2006, and prior to that he was an associate professor of environmental health sciences at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And I think he's going to share with us some of the public policy challenges that they have had in using biomonitoring. So come on up.
So, good morning. All right, that's it. Can the people in the back hear me? Just checking. All right, so this is really quite scary for all of
all
you.
All you have to do.
Yes,
even
push
I can
the,
do it.
Always advance that way. Yeah. All right. So let me first say thank you. I have several relationships to disclose. I know several people in the room and have worked with quite a few of them, actually, and they know who they are. And we'll just leave it at that. But I also want to point out a CSTE CDC fellow, Sybil Voicho, who's back there, who is actually joining us. We purloined her from the state of New York, and she's now working for 2 years as a CDC CSTE fellow in environmental health. And we'll answer all the questions that you ask me during this presentation. What I wanted to do was actually go through these. I want to whip through these because, frankly, this will be much more interesting if we have a discussion about biomonitoring. And since Dr. Das and Dr. Latshaw and Dr. Latshaw-Nassif have already covered a lot of the material that I'm going to talk about, I think we can do this fairly quickly. I do want to put this in context, though, and I will, if you'll indulge me. So one of the questions that Dr. Das raised was the question of using pre-existing samples like blood spots. So I have to give, in interest of full disclosure, my dad still goes into work every day at the Massachusetts State Public Health Laboratory, which is now part of the University of Massachusetts, in Jamaica Plain, and he actually helped to develop the regional screening program for New England, which is a six-state consortium of screening for various metabolic disorders. He did the hypothyroidism work that showed many years ago that if you intervene early with thyroid replacement, you can prevent cretinism and the more serious effects of hypothyroidism. So biomonitoring is not simple. So there are two things to say. First is I was genetically condemned to be here where I am doing what I'm doing today. I can't help that. So the second thing to say is that biomonitoring is not simple, and there are costs and trade-offs no matter what you do. So if you use a convenience sample, one of the things you have to be aware of is that in Massachusetts and many other states, there's a lot of controversy about using existing samples. It's not a simple thing to do. Women who are giving birth automatically, by statute, donate part of their infant's blood for purposes of preventing inborn metabolic disorders. For us to go back afterwards and then do what is basically research on or public health surveillance on those without consent is, from both a practical and an ethical point of view, challenging to do. So one should acknowledge, I think, at the outset that biomonitoring is not easy to do. And so from a policy point of view, you have to be very thoughtful about every aspect. And that includes even the aspects that might seem easy, like we've got a whole pool of blood spots that go back 30 years. Why don't we just go and look at those? So that being said, let me just sort of whip through these. As I said, I have several relationships to disclose. What I'm going to do is sort of take you through what Maryland did. And it's very comparable in some ways. The reason I can whip through this is because Dr. Das already talked about this in California. But in a state with no CDC funding, thank you very much, the discussion is way, way different than in a state with CDC funding. So let's be very clear about that. So we had a Children's Environmental Health and Protection Advisory Council. I'm the chair of the council, and it was started by a state legislator who was a real advocate for children's environmental health, a gentleman named James Hubbard, whose background is in corrections. Kid you not, he's a sheriff and somebody who's very interested in children's environmental health with no formal training and no relationship to health whatsoever. He has been the most effective advocate and spokesperson and champion for children's environmental health in the state. So one of the things to think about, this goes back to Dr. Das also, is that, you know, this is something that touches a lot of people, and it's not just the obvious people in the health professions that touch it. So HB 181 was a law which directed us at the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, assisted by the Department of Environment, to figure out what to do about the feasibility of biomonitoring in Maryland. So one of the things we did, the context for this in Maryland, was that we had legislation on BPA, we had legislation on flame retardants, both of which, parenthetically, were sponsored originally by Delegate Hubbard, but we didn't have anything like an outbreak that people were pointing to. If you look at Minnesota, Minnesota had a real concern about perfluorinated chemicals released by a company that will go nameless, and so they had a biomonitoring program that was started by community concerns. California, a lot of chemical exposures, big agricultural area, and a very aware population. Maryland, you know, so we do have some pockets where people are concerned about individual exposures, but it's not like there was a huge bus driving in a direction because of some big community concern. A lot of little communities maybe, but no one big thing. So HB 181, which was the bill that told us to do this, was filed in 2010 and was enacted, interestingly, unanimously, and signed by the governor. It's just to look at the feasibility of biomonitoring. And the question, should we do it? So it asked us to make recommendations on feasibility and which chemicals should be studied and then to report. So this is, again, this is stuff that Dr. Das has already alluded to. We were going to look at the international context for biomonitoring. As you know, Canada, Europe, all of the smart countries do a lot of biomonitoring. The national context for biomonitoring, and then other states. So we looked at, should we do this? We had a symposium. We're going backwards. Now we're moving forwards, always forwards. And so what we wanted to do also, and were directed to by the legislature particularly, is so what? The so what questions are not to be dismissed from a policy point of view. A, do these mean anything in terms of health outcomes? Not a foregone conclusion. And B, what's the impact on healthcare costs? Because, you know, in some cases, this may jack up healthcare costs considerably. Any of you who have received, are there any clinicians in the room? Okay. So just a show of hands, you don't have to disclose which laboratory it is. How many of you that just raised your hands have seen one of those reports from certain clinical laboratories that will go nameless that show, and I apologize, graphs that look remarkably similar in some respects to the graphs that you saw from Dr. Das, with the green, the yellow, and the red for all kinds of metabolites. Just anybody seen those? Yeah, okay, so you know who you are. There's a good way to do this. There's a way that can drive a lot of unnecessary spending and concern and heartache to do this. So the context for this discussion is, you know, I've seen those patients also in clinical practice, and it's very important, to think about what this means. So we looked at the following questions. What would we learn that's new or different than anybody else? Second, what you know, what's different about Maryland that would compel us or not compel us to do biomonitoring on a state basis? What chemicals were of concern, and how do we bring together the groups that we've already talked about in a coordinated effort to do this? So one of the other things that we looked at, and Megan, who worked at Johns Hopkins, and she knew I was going to bring this up, already pointed to the fun of driving up and down the New York Thruway with blood in the back of your car. But there are specialized laboratory capacities across our region which should be taken advantage of. So we had a public symposium and listening session. We did a white paper. And then we issued a final report. Now, Dr. Doss may want to comment on this, but we asked, for example, California how much per program participant they had spent, because they also had some CDC funding, but they also had some state funding. They estimated that they spent somewhere for a comprehensive program participant, the budget was somewhere around $1,600 to $2,000 per program participant to do biomonitoring. And then we looked at, okay, so what questions? Is biomonitoring effective in terms of answering the questions that you think are of interest? And what can you do with the results? And so Dr. Doss has already talked about these. You can look at general population distributions of chemicals. You can look at the effectiveness of interventions, like if you shut down mercury release from power plants, does it result in lowering of mercury levels? You can look at cumulative exposures, and then you can provide guidance to clinicians. So we issued a series of findings after all of this, and the findings were, one, with appropriate funding, note, with appropriate funding, sure, we can do anything, but there is a resource question here. And there's a lot of laboratory capacity in Maryland. We got more laboratories, not just the state public health laboratories. We have the NIH, we have the we got lots of laboratories. Second, Fragmire. Who knows what the most important substances are? Because that's going to be determined by local conditions. There is not an overwhelming state interest that we could find to steer us in one direction or another. So we could either do background like NHANES for Maryland, or we could look at focused results. But there was certainly nothing driving in as opposed to in other states. Third, if we're going to do this and we're going to spend money, the smartest thing for the state would be to do a pilot program with a couple of chemicals, because the instant you start adding additional chemicals, additional methods, it's going to be additional money. Fourth, any biomonitoring system should be cognizant of issues related to environmental justice and social equity, and we've already talked about that. And then five, you cannot do this unless it's really driven by and involves the public substantially. So just in terms of final policy considerations, so if you look at, and I want to bring environmental public health tracking into this for those of you who are aware of it, because I think that there are some parallels here. The goal of environmental public health tracking, as it was originally done by the Pew Commission, was to allow states and local communities to look not only at themselves, but at national references, so that they could understand the context in which they were interpreting their own exposures, their own environmental health picture. Similarly, a national biomonitoring system is not a national biomonitoring program. It's a way to think about answering local questions, as Megan said right at the outset, but with references that are national and state and allow you to make policy judgments based on the best available data. However, and this is true for tracking and it's true for biomonitoring, anybody who's read a newspaper in the last couple of weeks, the money at the moment, it's very hard to see how you do this on a large scale. So the important thing to do, I think, is to think about putting the architecture in place. You have to put the data standards in place. You have to think a lot about these issues up front, because when the money becomes available, then you'll be able to take advantage of it. But the emphasis right now, I think, from a policy point of view, is less on having a big biomonitoring system than on focusing on using some really good examples, pilots across the country, country and creating data architecture, data standards, methods, exactly what APHL is trying to do now, so that when resources become available or when there's an overriding concern, we don't have to reinvent a wheel that's already there. So, again, it takes a village. This is the village. And I think at this point, we're just going to do questions generally.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
You going to moderate?
Sure.
Okay.
That's my fun part.
Can we run to the back? Or are we staying up here?
You're staying here. Oh. All right. We have, surprisingly, 5 minutes left. And I'm thrilled. Have you ever been to an APHA session that had time for questions at the end? So I want to applaud all of our presenters for being very timely in their presentations to allow that. So we do have 5 minutes for questions. They can be for any of our panelists, and I see one over here.
Hi.